Lecture 8, Stagflation and the 1970s.
There are many myths in which the gods reach down and punish those who are presumptuous about the extent of their abilities or their knowledge. At the start of the 1960s, you may remember, there was a sense among economists that they knew all the answers. The 1970s were their punishment. The 1960s, remember, end with sort of a legacy of slowly growing inflation. In 1967, the inflation rate is 3.1%. The next year, it goes up to 4.2%. The next year, to 5.5%. And the rise seems somehow inexorable. Now, of course, 5.5% doesn't look so terrible. But when you've been used to maybe 1% inflation, it doesn't look so good. Remember, inflation is cumulative over time, and it cuts your money in half eventually. But if inflation is only 1.5%, as it was in the early 60s, it takes 48 years for inflation to cut the value of a dollar in half. If inflation is 5.5%, it takes just 13 years for inflation to cut the value of a dollar in half. Public pressure is growing to do something about inflation, to fix it now. In particular, public opinion polls are showing a growing popularity of wage and price controls. And in a somewhat shocking move in August of 1971, one of the more conservative Republican presidents, Richard Nixon, imposed wage and price controls on the U.S. economy. And Nixon did prove over his career that he was willing to make the big move. You may remember that he was the Republican president who went to China. And I guess if a lifelong anti-communist can go to China and recognize the communist government, that a lifelong free market president can impose wage and price controls on the whole economy. My guess also, though, is that for people of Nixon's generation, wage and price controls were perhaps not as strange as they may seem at the end of the century. Because after all, many of them had lived through wage and price controls during World War II, limited controls during the Korean War, ongoing controls on certain goods like oil prices. And so now we have a hard time imagining what it was like, but then I think folks were more used to the idea that the government might sometimes step in and do this. Not to give you the wrong impression, most economists, including the people on Nixon's advisors at the Council of Economic Advisers, were strongly against these controls. The controls went through several phases which aren't real important to us now. They weren't all lifted until April 1974. And the controls were not a disaster. They did not ruin the economy, but they weren't exactly a good thing either. For example, the controls caused lots of evasion in various ways. Let me give you an example. Imagine that you're selling dishwashers and you want to raise the price of the dishwasher. Well, you're not allowed to do that because there's price controls. But what if you put out a new model? So instead of the XLM3 dishwasher, you have the XLM4 dishwasher. Well, that's a whole new product. You can charge a whole different price for that product if you want to. So there were enormous arguments over whether the quality of products were being changed in various ways. Give you an example of the level of bizarreness here. George Meany, then head of the AFL-CIO, publicly charged that the number of matzo balls in Mrs. Adler's matzo ball soup had been diminished from 4 to 3 in clear violation of the wage and price controls. So the head of the Government Price Commission bought a whole bunch of cans of soup, carefully opened them in private to make sure this was not true, and then on Face the Nation, the TV program triumphantly opened a can of matzo ball soup to prove that the number of matzo balls had not been diminished. You know, where they weren't trying to evade various price controls, they, you know, you had all the classic problems of what happens when you stop prices from going up. After all, if you stop prices from going up, you can get in positions where people are going to demand a lot more than folks are willing to supply. Classic example, the controls are imposed on beef prices. So the farmers say, well, we're not going to slaughter cows because we can't get anything for the meat. So shortages develop of beef. So eventually the government says, okay, we'll let the price rise. And then, of course, the farmers are willing to slaughter the cows and beef comes back to the markets again. With copper, when we imposed domestic price ceilings, then, of course, people started exporting the copper abroad where there weren't price ceilings and getting more for it overseas. With oil, we had a problem where we had old oil, which had been discovered in the past, but we knew that if we kept that old oil price, then people wouldn't explore for new oil. And we wanted them to explore for new oil. So there were separate prices for old oil and for new oil, which are, of course, you know, chemically identical and used for the same purpose. You can just imagine some of the difficulties that causes in the market. And they're also often under-the-table payments to get around the price controls, particularly in some things like auto parts or trucking industries. And in wages, many unions, like the United Auto Workers, started going back to that game in World War II, where if there's wage controls, you demand greater benefits, because there's not a limit on your benefits in the same way. And so things like dental benefits become very popular during the early 1970s. Most bothersome of all, outside of all these games, is that the wage and price controls don't stop the inflation. Sure, they knock it down to about 3% in 1972, but then it raises to 6.2% in 1973, 11% in 1974, and 9% in 1975. So, we have a lesson here that we'd learned from the 1960s. Economic forces are what create price changes and inflation. If the Federal Reserve is trying to pump up the money supply to stimulate the economy, and they go too far, then you're going to end up getting some inflation. And you just can't bottle it up. You can't avoid it from happening without all these kinds of trade-offs. The next big event of the 1970s is the 1973-74 recession, which is commonly thought of as caused by OPEC. The war between Israel and the Arab states breaks out in 1973. Many of the Arab states belong to something called the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, which had been around since about 1960 without doing very much. However, during the war, this sort of brought the Arab countries together. They decided to flex their collective muscles, and they placed an embargo on oil. They refused to export oil to the United States, and that caused a shortage where prices of oil literally quadrupled in a period of a very short time. This led to the price, there were price controls on oil, government allocation of oil, and of course, with all of this system, there are going to be shortages here and there and difficulties in getting oil allocated. Now, for the economy as a whole, oil is an input for many different industries. It's a source of heating. It's a source of electricity. It's a source of petrochemicals. It's a source of fertilizer. It's a cost in transportation. And so when the price of oil goes up, that has a broad-based effect through a lot of industries across the entire economy. And this helps trigger a deep recession, where businesses start losing money, patterns of business are greatly disrupted, and the size of the economy between 1974 and 75 shrinks by about 3%. Now, that's not the Great Depression, of course, but it's still plenty nasty at the time. Unemployment goes up from 5.6% in 1974, which, remember, they thought was pretty high in the early 1960s, and zooms up to 8.5% in 1975. It stays above 7% for another couple of years. Inflation takes off, as I mentioned before. It hits 9% in 74 and 75. The higher prices of oil are driving up prices all over the economy in some ways. And so for a few months, in 74 in particular, you have the specter of double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment rates. Now, not all of this is the price of oil. Remember, price pressures were building earlier back in the late 1960s. Also, the recession is not all about oil. The Federal Reserve decided it would fight this inflation by raising interest rates, and it starts doing that in 1972. The federal funds rate, the particular rate they control, goes from 4% in 72 to over 8% in 1973 and 10% in 1974. So the Fed is slowing down the economy to some extent. You've already got some inflation built into the system, and the oil kind of comes along on top of that to make everything somewhat worse. It's hard to describe the level of shock which was involved in these higher oil prices. There was a sense that these foreigners, these Middle Easterners, had just taken over control of the U.S. economy. They'd thrown us into this terrible recession, and we had nothing we could do about it. I mean, what were we going to do? Go over and bomb the oil field? That would be really smart in terms of getting more oil. So really, all we could do was kind of sit here and just pay them the money. Pay them what they demanded. And we really didn't have any control over it at all. I think it was an enormous sense of a shock to America's sense of itself as a national power. And particularly in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, which we didn't feel too good about either, it really made America feel diminished in the world in strong ways. But the economy does recover in the mid-70s, faster than many people had thought it would. The Fed brings interest rates back down. That stimulates the economy. We begin to use conservation. We change our personal patterns and our industrial patterns to use less oil. We begin to turn down our thermostats, drive smaller cars, all those kinds of things. And it sort of looks, for a while during the mid-1970s, like, sure, we had this terrible shock. There are some new realities here we have to deal with, but the economy's coming out of it, and things will be okay. And so just in case we didn't get the point, we get it all over again, one more time, 1979. This time, the disturbance in the Middle East, instead of being a war between Israel and the Arab states, is the war between Iran and Iraq, and also the fall of the Shah of Iran. Iran is an enormous oil supplier. They are thrown into chaos and turmoil. There's a shortage of oil. Again, oil prices go up. This time they triple. Again, there are gas shortages, gas lines, rationing schemes, things about how people with odd-numbered license plates can buy oil one day and even-numbered license plates can buy it the next day. Frankly, that always seemed to me like just the dumbest thing. I mean, how does that change how much anybody drives? It just creates inconvenience. But again, the effect of the higher oil prices is spread throughout the whole economy. Again, we get a recession. It starts in January of 1980. And this is sometimes called a double-dip recession. The economy declines until July of that year, it levels out for a while, and then it starts declining down again for reasons we'll need to talk about. Unemployment again rises. It goes from 5.8% in 79 to above 7% in 80 and 81 and up to almost 10% in 82 and 83. We'll need to talk about the reasons for the early 80s. Really, in the next lecture. Inflation gets unhinged as well. They had gotten it down to about 6% in 1976 and 77, but it's back up to 9%, almost double digits again, by 1980 and 1991. Now, this combination of high unemployment and high inflation came as a real shock to economists. After all, when you think about the standard model of economics, which we've sort of been relying on through all of these lectures, you could either have inflation if the economy is doing really well and has really low unemployment, like during a war when there's lots of demand, or you could have high unemployment when the economy is really slow, like during the Great Depression. But you tended to have one or the other. You didn't have both at the same time. In the 1970s, you get both, and the term stagflation is describing that situation where both things happen at once. So what do you do? I mean, how do you fight stagflation? To understand the dilemma, think about the problem if you were running the Federal Reserve System in the 1970s. According to the beliefs in the 1960s, remember, your job is to keep interest rates low and keep stimulating the economy. So you think, okay, we're having a really deep recession in 1974-75, another one later on in the early 80s. So what I should be doing is keeping interest rates really low in order to stimulate the economy and fight that unemployment. But if you do that, if you keep interest rates really low and put lots of money and buying power out there in the economy, you're feeding the inflation, which is also high and is very nearly double digit. So you're sort of caught. Whichever way you turn, you're going to be feeding one of these problems. The choice the Fed made, pretty much, although it wasn't real clear on what it was doing, was to err on the side of trying to stimulate the economy. And there were still these ideas that we might be able to fight inflation through an incomes policy, through the jawbone, through whip inflation now. And so the Fed was basically contributing to the inflation, but saying, hey, at least we're avoiding the unemployment problem. The problem of how the Fed's thinking evolved and through this trap will be taken up in the next lecture. The 1970s are also a time, I think, when the global economy and the impact of the global economy really hits the U.S. with renewed force. You'll remember that back in the early part of the century, the global economy was quite important. Then there's sort of this diminution during the world wars and the depression, and then the global economy starts coming back in the 1950s and 1960s. In the 1970s, the disruptive effect of the global economy, I think, really becomes apparent in a strong way. Part of this, of course, is just our dependence on foreign oil and the higher oil prices. And so that's one way in which the global economy was bothering us. But it also seems true that the global economy touches us in a lot of different ways. One way is that floating exchange rates arrive for the U.S. economy. You'll remember that in the aftermath of World War II, when they set up the International Monetary Fund, the idea was to keep exchange rates between countries pretty much fixed, so they wouldn't change a whole lot over time, and that the dollar would be hooked up to gold, but everyone else would sort of be hooked up to the dollar. In the 1970s, this begins to run into a problem, really in the late 1960s. Remember, the U.S. is running small trade surpluses each year through most of the 1950s and 1960s. We're taking our money, we're investing money abroad. Now, what's happening in those foreign countries? They're ending up with all these U.S. investments, these U.S. dollars that we're investing abroad. And for years and years, the central banks in those countries, their equivalent to the Federal Reserve, just sort of kept those dollars. So what would happen? An investor would go over to France, buy something in France. The French investor would go down to the bank and trade the dollars in for francs or whatever, because, of course, you need to have francs to do this. And the French central bank would just keep those dollars. It would just hold the dollars as an asset. But over time, over the 50s and 1960s, the number of dollars that they're holding abroad is building up and building up and building up. We begin to have what they call a dollar glut. And the banks don't want to be holding that many dollars. So they begin to come back over to the Federal Reserve and say, look, we'd like to trade you some of all these dollars that we're holding in the French banks, and we want gold instead. We want to trade it in for gold, because officially we're still on a gold standard. And officially, you still have to trade us dollars for gold. Well, during the 1960s, the U.S. gold stock is dropping. It goes from like $22 billion down to about $11 billion by 1970, as we keep the other countries keep trading in their dollars for gold. And it's clear that this situation is just not working. We're going to run out of gold. So in 1971, President Nixon says, the heck with it. We're just not going to trade dollars for gold anymore. Sorry, folks. We got to think about something else. This situation is just not working. And by 1973, a new system is in place where the value of the dollar is not going to be set according to gold anymore, but is just going to be set by private traders in the market. It's going to be set by supply and demand. Whoever wants to buy dollars and sell dollars will just go down to the local bank, and the bank will just raise the price or lower it, depending on whether there's a greater supply of dollars that are being traded or a greater demand for dollars being traded. It's kind of strange in a way if you think about it. Nixon at the time is imposing wage and price controls on the domestic economy, but he's saying that for the exchange rate, that's going to be set by the market. But those two things are happening simultaneously. Now, you know, this had to happen. There really wasn't any way around it. As the world economy has gotten bigger and bigger and closer to closer, been tied together by communications and different transportation, you just can't control in a specific way what your currency is going to be worth everywhere in the world. The global economy is huge. National economies are, relatively speaking, not so big, and we're just not willing to, you know, keep our dollar at a fixed price regardless of what else happens in the world. Things do need to adjust sometimes, and the market is not a bad way of having them adjust. There has, of course, since the 1970s, been an enormous amount of thought about could we have exchange rates be somewhat stable but still adjust in one way or another. And by the 1990s, the European nations, for example, are trying to think about how they might blend together their currencies and keep them fixed with regard to each other. But the European nations are having a terrible time doing that. It's not at all clear, as these lectures are given, they're going to succeed in being able to tie things together. And for the United States, I think the attitude we've basically taken is, hey, if we keep inflation fairly low, we keep the economy growing at a fairly reasonable pace, hey, then we'll just let the dollar do what it wants. And sure, sometimes it'll go up in the market and sometimes it'll go down, but, you know, just let the market determine it like it does for lots of other things that are out there in the economy. So we begin to open up to the foreign economy in the sense that now we're letting foreign markets and exchange markets control the exchange rate of our currency. And the government is no longer saying that it's even going to try to do very much about that. The other big change in foreign trade is that there's an expansion of global trade in the 1970s. Viewed in proportion to the economy, exports expand fairly dramatically during the 1970s. Around 1970, exports are kind of in the range of 4, 5, 6% of GDP. By late in the 1970s, they're kind of in the range of 7 or 8% of GDP. So that's a fairly large jump, and it takes us back to where the export levels in relation to the size of the economy that we had at the turn of the century, back in around 1900 and 1910. Well, why did this happen? Why did we get more trade? Well, one reason was that there were GATT talks during the 1960s and early 1970s. And remember, the GATT talks were about reducing the level of tariffs over time. So the mid-60s talks in Geneva reduced the level of tariffs. The early 1970s talks in Tokyo reduced the tariffs still further. So one reason we had more trade was there weren't so many taxes on trade. Everyone was reducing their level of tariffs. Another reason I think trade expanded was that the shock of the higher oil prices caused U.S. industries to restructure in all kinds of really dramatic ways. To choose just one example, when oil prices and gasoline prices went up so much, that made Japanese cars look a lot more attractive. So there was an enormous scramble where we started importing more Japanese cars and trying to export different things instead. And so it's a time of great turmoil, a time of great movement, and companies are both importing more and exporting more. It's important to remember that imports and exports are always somewhat linked together. For example, think about the situation of the major oil producers. The major oil producers are earning all these U.S. dollars because, after all, they sell gasoline in the United States, we pay in dollars. Well, what do they do with those dollars? A lot of what they do is they use those dollars to buy U.S. exports, to buy U.S. goods and services, or else they use them to invest in the United States and buy real estate or land or stock or different things like that. So when we start buying a lot more from other countries and they earn dollars, then that money tends to flow back to us as exports as well. So for all of these kinds of reasons, we're much more open to the global economy. We're feeling buffeted by the global economy in ways that we really hadn't before. And there's a sense that the global economy controls us, or at least has a greater influence over us than it did in the 1950s and 1960s. With all I've said, it may seem odd that I believe the single greatest event of the 1970s, or the single most important event, is one we haven't talked about yet. And that event is the productivity slowdown that happens in the early 1970s. Let's start off by just talking about what's meant by a productivity slowdown, by the magnitude of what happened, and sort of the dimensions of the problem. Remember, I've been saying over and over and over that wages and growth tend to track each other pretty closely. What you produce, broadly speaking, determines what you can pay. Doesn't mean it's perfect every single year, but over long periods of time, the two do move together. Now, in the early 1970s, and some people would say the late 1960s, the dating is a little bit uncertain, productivity slows down dramatically in the United States. What are the figures? Remember that wage growth had been about 2.5% a year from 1948 to 1973. Those are the boom years of productivity. Productivity is going up 2.5% a year. Wages are also going up at that rate. Since then, since about 1973, the average productivity rate in a year has been maybe 0.5% a year, maybe 1% a year. Now, that's a huge difference if you compound it out over the time since 1973. That's several decades. And remember, say we're talking 2% every single year over that time. What that means is that over 20 or 25 years, that 2% every single year accumulates into like 50%. We're saying that because of the productivity slowdown in the early 1970s, wages now are perhaps 50% less than they would otherwise have been. And that's an extraordinary difference. That's an extraordinary change. If you think about it in terms of the size of the economy is toward the end of the century is, more or less $7 trillion. If it was 50% bigger, the economy would be like $10 trillion, $10.5 trillion. And you know, you may have a lot of concerns about social equality and different things, but believe me, there's not very many problems you can't put a good dent in with $3.5 trillion extra dollars. The slowdown in growth that happened has been an enormously terrible thing for the U.S. economy. It's growth that we never saw. It's growth that never happened. But the fact that it never happened means that we are far, far, far poorer than we would have been if we could have sustained that same rate of growth over the last 25 years or so. That growth is gone. There's no way to get it back now. The best we can do is think to the future and try and avoid it continuing to happen. Why did we have the great growth slowdown? Why did things diminish in that way? Well, I'm going to give you a lot of reasons, and I should say in advance that whenever somebody says to you, well, there are about 8 different theories for why something happened, you should suspect that probably they don't really know. And that's probably the honest answer with regard to the great productivity slowdown. I can give you a lot of theories. They all may have a little bit of truth in them, but the honest truth is that it is still a deep mystery to economists. And it's a mystery of tremendous importance, which a lot of people are working on, and we honestly don't know the answer. So let's run through some of the likely candidates, and I'll try and give you a sense of why these are partial answers at best. First of all, maybe it was the raise in oil prices. Maybe the higher oil prices of 1974 and 75 were what slowed down the economy. Remember, of course, they did drive us into recessions not once, but twice, and did help to aggravate inflation. But how would they affect productivity? The argument would be that because of the higher prices of oil, management had to spend a whole lot of time changing what they were doing, thinking about different ways that they would carry out their industrial processes. And so instead of thinking about how do we get more productivity, the automakers were thinking, my word, we have to switch over from these big old boat cars of the 1960s to smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. And so those changes are not the best times to be thinking about greater efficiency. So maybe people's attention was distracted by the oil shock, and that caused the difficulty. Well, that's not a terrible explanation. It has some difficulties. One is, of course, that other countries suffered less of an oil shock because other countries had much higher taxes on gasoline and oil to begin with. So when oil prices went up, they cut down their taxes on oil and gasoline, and their economies had less of an impact from that increase. However, those other countries also had a productivity slowdown. So if the higher oil prices were the cause, then why doesn't it affect the fact that it doesn't affect these other countries which have these extremely high oil prices? Why didn't it affect people who had less of a shock from the oil prices going up? It's also true that the price of oil comes back down in the early 1980s. Well, if higher oil prices caused the problem, shouldn't lower oil prices have fixed the problem? Well, they didn't. The productivity slowdown has continued on. Moreover, when you try and measure and trace the actual effects from oil through the rest of the economy, it's worth remembering that while oil is used a lot of places, oil really is only maybe 1 or 2% of the economy. And so even when we talk about the price, you know, increasing some or going up and down, we're talking about something that affects only a tiny little percentage of the economy. And it's hard to imagine how that one little tail could wag the whole dog of the economy and make the entire economy slow down for decades afterwards. It just doesn't seem like by itself it's a big enough factor. A second possibility that was often raised was that science investment might have slowed down research investment. Remember that 1950s are the decade when research and development takes off. The 1960s are a decade when it begins to move into the civilian sector. But actually, as the Vietnam War drops off and as the space program peaks in 1968, we begin to see research and development spending slowing down and not increasing at the same rate. In fact, declining into the early 1970s. So one argument is, maybe that slowed down productivity growth. It's a reasonable enough claim, but when you think about it, the gains from productivity growth take years to translate through into the economy. You don't have a scientific discovery 1 year or spend $100 in the lab 1 year and automatically get the productivity increase next year. So the sharpness of the turn, the way in which it happens so quickly, seems to argue that it shouldn't be research and development. Research and development could be a longer, slow-term kind of thing, but it shouldn't be as quick as this. And also, the change in U.S. research and development spending shouldn't have caused a slowdown in the global productivity of all the countries in the world. So again, probably a contributor, probably not the main cause. A third thing people have put forward, what about inflation taking off in the early 1970s? And again, the argument would be inflation disrupts the economy. And if you have a high rate of inflation, and inflation is getting higher and higher, then business people need to focus on whatever they can do that might protect them against that inflation. They need to think about their cash flow. They need to think about tax implications. They need to be worrying about all those kinds of things. They can't be spending their time and energy thinking about more efficient plants because inflation is their bigger problem. Inflation disrupts markets. It's hard to do advanced planning in a world where prices are jumping up and down. Now, I guess, again, sure, business does need to take this extra factor of higher inflation into account. And sure, if you have real hyperinflation, if an economy has 50% inflation a month or something like that, yeah, that will be very destructive to economic growth. But while the inflation was going up, remember, we're talking inflation which was about 5% a year. Is it really plausible that 5% a year was enough to throw all of business planning into an enormous tailspin which we haven't recovered from for several decades? Somehow that just doesn't seem likely. It again seems like we've got a little tail trying to wag a big dog here. A fourth possibility people point out, women entering the labor market. What's the link here between women entering the labor market and lower productivity? Well, remember that we have a long-term pattern going on here. Women entering the labor market that starts at the turn of the century and goes on and on and on through World War II, through the 50s, into the 1960s. However, the number of women entering the labor market is particularly strong in the 1960s and 1970s. Partly this is the moms of baby boomers who are sort of coming back into the labor force. Partly it's baby boomer kids who are now about 20 and 30 years old who are now entering the labor market for the first time. I'll give you an example. In 1960, of women in the age 25 to 44 age bracket, less than 40% were in the labor force in 1960. By 1980, in the 25 to 44 labor bracket, 65% are in the paid labor force. So there's a large increase in the number of women who are working. Now, how does this relate to the productivity slowdown? At the risk of simplifying, you can think about the women in the labor market at this time in two big groups. One group is women who were in the labor market all along. The other group is the new arrivals. Now, the new arrivals tend to be arriving, as new arrivals always do, with fewer skills that they can really use in the paid labor market. I mean, they may have lots and lots of life skills, but that doesn't necessarily help your first year in an office job or help as much as you might think. So it's often noted by the feminist movement in the 1960s and 1970s that through this time period, women are getting about 63 cents for every dollar earned by a man, and that number isn't changing much through the 1970s. But that number actually hides what's going on. What's going on is there's one group of women who've been in the labor force all along, and they are getting raises right along the whole time. And then there's this large group of new entrants who are not being paid as much because they're new entrants into the labor market. And the balance between those two forces means that the average wage rate for a woman was staying at about 63 cents on the dollar through that time. So the argument is that somehow productivity slowed down because there was a surge of low productivity workers at about that time, a surge of new people entering the labor market. Now, if that's the truth, then you would think that that problem would go away over time. Because after all, those people would get experience. And by the 1980s or so, you would begin to see that the productivity slowdown would have ended as a result. That gap hasn't exactly ended. Also, if you sort of work through a calculation, you say, this is the raw number of women, this is an estimate of their productivity, how much of the productivity slowdown can we explain with this factor? You just don't get a very good number. I mean, it's not a large share of the productivity slowdown. And so while that's something you hear people say, lots of low productivity workers, women entering the labor force, actually, it just doesn't seem like that's a big enough factor to explain what's going on. A fifth factor, and you begin to see the sense of economists going, it's got to be something. How about environmental regulation or regulation more broadly? After all, 1970 is a year when we have lots of legislative changes in our attitudes toward the environment. It's the year when Richard Nixon signs the Environmental Protection Agency bill into law. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is created. We have the first really stringent laws about clean air. It's the first Earth Day on April 22nd, 1970. One of Nixon's government commissions, which the Council on Environmental Quality, put out a report in 1970, and they said, historians may one day call 1970 the year of the environment. 1970 marks the beginning of a new emphasis on the environment, a turning point, a year when the quality of life has become more than a phrase. Environment and pollution have become everyday words, and ecology has become almost a religion for some of the young. There's a lot of talk about these new laws kicking in. Maybe these new laws imposed such high costs on business that they caused the productivity slowdown. Fortunately, I guess for those of us who like to see those laws passed to clean up the environment, that doesn't seem to be true. Particularly in their first few years, those laws didn't impose very high costs at all, and it took a while for the cost to kick in over time. Moreover, if it is these kinds of laws about industrial regulation, it's generally felt that those laws impose a cost, but they're a cost that you can just pay. You can still focus on efficiency. You can still focus on productivity in the future. And so it's not clear why they should lead to some kind of a permanent slowdown in productivity levels. Other people point to the regulation of the wage and price controls and say that might have caused the slowdown. But after all, the wage and price controls have been gone for more than 20 years now, and so it's not clear that they could have been something that had an impact for 20 years later. As a broad statement, just as an aside, it's fair to say that because of the laws passed in the early 70s and since, that the nation's air and water are actually somewhat cleaner today than they were in the 1960s. And so I think those laws have been a genuine success, and there's no real reason to feel like they contributed in a strong way to the productivity slowdown. Although, of course, they did have costs and benefits like everything else. Yet another explanation, declining educational performance. As everybody knows because of the disputes over education, in the late 1960s, test scores like SAT scores begin to go down. There's a huge argument over why and who's to blame and all that. But, you know, few people would claim that students of the 1990s are better grounded in basic background than the students were their peers 30 years ago. On the other hand, declining test scores is not the best way to try and explain why the whole economy slows down. I mean, test scores going down a little bit each year means the new people who entered the labor force that year might have been slightly less qualified, but the entire rest of all the workers in the labor force were exactly the same people. So it's hard to say that, you know, that slow slowdown should have caused this decline to happen so abruptly in the early 1970s. If the decline were long and steady, you'd be able to come up with a different story. An explanation that's related to education would be that our levels of education that we were providing to people and the broad expansion of education that we talked about earlier really slowed down during the 1970s. For example, by 1970, it was true that the median student in schools had about 12.2 years of schooling. So now we're at a time when the median student in school, the middle of the distribution, has a high school education. By the mid-1990s, the median is up to about 12.8 years of schooling. What you can really think of happening is that over the first part of the century, the big push is just to get everybody into school, get them through high school, get them up and finishing high school. But by about 1965, 1970, that goal had more or less been broadly accomplished. And we didn't have the same opportunities for continuing to expand education unless we were really going to push everybody into college, which we really haven't done. So maybe the earlier growth was part of the increase in education. And then when we stopped having as much increase every year, then we didn't were able to generate the same additional growth in future years. But again, this is a factor which is a slow long-term trend. It's not something that kicks in 1973 like we would really like to have happen. Some people talk about union power. They say, you know, oh, we slowed down. It's all the fault of the unions. But you know, union power has been already declining since the early 1950s. It declines through the 1970s, and it declines through the 1990s. So it's not likely to be the cause of a new problem that starts in the mid-1970s. And frankly, if unions are the problem, then America is kind of on its way to finding a solution because union power keeps going down and down and down. A final explanation that's sometimes given is the shift to service industries, more and more service sector jobs. Now, as you know, almost all of the growth in jobs from the 1950s on happens in the service sector. Service sector jobs are about 60% of all the jobs, if you include government jobs, by 1950. By 1970, they're 66% of all the jobs. By 1980, they're 72% of all the jobs. And by the end of the century, more than 80% of the jobs in the economy will be service jobs. The argument here would be, as a productivity argument, that it's hard to increase productivity in services. One classical example, due to the economist William Baumol, who calls this the cost disease of the service sector, is that certain service sector jobs, it's just very hard to increase productivity. An example, string quartet. It's very hard to increase the productivity of a string quartet. It takes four people. It takes a certain amount of time. Now, there are a lot of jobs out there in the service sector, teaching school, doctors and healthcare, some government things, some law things, where you can imagine becoming somewhat more efficient over time, but it's a little bit hard to imagine that you're going to double the number of students in a class year after year after year after year. You're going to run into some natural limits at some point. And so the argument is that as we get more and more service sector jobs, our productivity growth is just naturally going to slow down. Well, if that's true, then we do have something of an explanation. It's not the best explanation because we're still using a long-term trend to explain something that happens suddenly. But if it is true, then as other countries follow the U.S. toward more and more service sector jobs, we should see their productivity slow down as well. I think it is a key question for our economy, and one that we really need to think about, as to how we can use our new technology and machinery and equipment to increase productivity in service sector jobs. The new computer and information technologies seem to offer some possibilities along these lines, but we really need to think about how that's going to work, because the only way we can get people's wages going up again is to get productivity going up again. Actually, the 1970s looked fairly good on economic growth. The reason, of course, is because there are lots of extra workers coming into the economy. So during the 1970s, we're getting economic growth from more labor. What we really want to be doing, of course, if we can, is getting our growth from more productivity, because more productivity is what's going to drive up wages and drive up our standard of living over time. To put it in more practical terms, the household standard of living goes up in the 1970s because more households have two people working. And what we'd really like to have is standard of living going up because whoever's working is earning more and getting more buying power as a result. The final thing I'd like to talk about in the 1970s is the evolution of entitlements and of dependents in that decade. By entitlements, what I really mean are Social Security and Medicare. These 1960s programs are, well, Medicare is a 1960s program, Social Security has been around longer. But in the 1970s, they really begin to take off. For Medicare, total cash outlays in 1970 are $5 billion. By 1980, it's up to $25 billion. Now, part of that is inflation, but a lot of it is just raw growth in the cost of what they're providing. The trend line is nowhere but up. By the end of the 1980s, outlays for Medicare will be up to $80 billion. And for the turn of the century, Medicare projections are $150 billion. So you just see this dramatic rise as we took the cost consciousness out of the system. For Social Security, the big change in the 1970s is that it was decided that because of the high inflation, we would start indexing all the Social Security payments for inflation. If we hadn't done this, then inflation during the 1970s would have eaten away the value of a Social Security check by about half during that decade. That was politically unacceptable. So we said we're going to start doing something where we just automatically increase Social Security checks along with the rate of inflation. That, of course, was a very good thing for the elderly. It protected their Social Security payments. It also cost a lot of money. Payments from the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Fund, which is the main Social Security fund, go from $27 billion in 1970 to over $100 billion in 1980. And they're headed for $360 billion at the turn of the century. So the costs of these entitlements are really rising dramatically. Now, when you think about it, this is really scary. It's scary because the baby boom generation isn't even old yet. They don't start retiring until about 2010. So we're talking about problems that are happening just from the fact that people are retiring sooner and living longer and spending more on health care. And those problems are very much with us toward the end of the century. And toward the 1990s, we'll have to think about how we might address them. The other big change in the 1970s is that the war on poverty, which had been started in the 1960s, begins to have just a terrible time. The number of Americans below the poverty line, which is, you know, the government line, it's adjusted for inflation and for family size, basically just hangs in 1970. The poverty rate's about 10% in 1970. It occasionally goes up a little higher in a bad year, a little lower in a good year, but it's still 10% by about 1980. So poverty and ending poverty has turned out to be a whole lot harder than we thought back in the 1950s and 1960s. Now, the reasons why that's harder are multifold, but many people would list at least some of the following factors as being important. One, of course, is this problem of the inner cities, of poor people being left in the inner cities as the jobs and the wealth moved out to the suburbs. Another is that in our new high technology economy, we have more and more demand for skilled workers. And those who don't get a really good school education or who don't finish high school are going to have a harder and harder and harder time. There's a breakdown of two-parent families, and two-parent families have more energy and time to invest time in raising kids. They also, single-parent families tend to be more economically insecure, which often translate into the kids ending up in a worse school district of some kind. There's the growth of a welfare or an entitlement mentality, which certainly hasn't helped some folks. And there's the problem that what economists call the poverty trap kicks in. And the idea of the poverty trap is just that once we've guaranteed people all all these things like Medicaid and food stamps and AFDC and a lot of other things, it just doesn't pay for them to take a low-wage job. They're not going to raise their standard of living. They could work full-time at a minimum wage job the entire year, and they would be no better off than if they sat at home and received the basic welfare payments that will be coming to them. And particularly, if you're a parent with kids and you're worried about the kids having health insurance, then you don't want to lose your Medicaid benefits. So going to work and losing those would be a nasty thing. These are not separable causes. I can't really say which are the most important, but I can tell you one cause which does not apply at all during the 1970s. Interestingly enough, the average welfare payment declines straight through the 1970s and continues declining after that. The average state AFDC payment per household actually declines 30%. Adjusted for inflation, from 1970 to 1980. From 1980 to 1990, it fell on average another 10%. And by the mid-1990s, it's fallen yet another 10%. If we could just fix the problems of welfare by trimming back on welfare payments, we would have done it. We've been trimming back on welfare payments for almost three decades at this point. What we really need to do is try and figure out ways of changing people's life patterns, which is much harder than cutting their government support checks. When I think back on the 1970s, I think of a time of enormous stress and dislocation, where we're trying to come to grips with our own limitations of our knowledge, our limitations of what government can do. It is not a happy time, but it is a necessary step toward maturity.